Welcome back to the Path of Longevity show, and I'm your host, Dr. Robert Lufkin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Steven Sidaroff.
I've been looking forward to this particular episode for a long time. It's actually a UCLA colleague. Dr. Emron Meyer is a gastroenterologist, a neuroscientist, and distinguished professor, research professor in the Department of Medicine, Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He's also a Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience director, executive director, and founding director of the Goodman Luskin Microbiome Center, also at UCLA. Emron, it's such a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Stephen, and really look forward to this conversation.
Yes, thank you. And by the way, as I mentioned, you know, I've heard you speak before, so this is a piece of the whole puzzle around longevity that really is very important. Can you just give us a little bit background on how you got interested in the area that of your research?
Yeah, I mean, I could give you the long version, you know, which I'm still looking back now. I'm kind of amazed how it happened. I mean, from an early interest in mainly in psychology and the social sciences when I was in college. And then just because of my, excellent GPA, people talked me into, you have to go to medical school, which I went into without a lot of enthusiasm, but it was always the idea I would ultimately go into psychiatry. So, you know, that continued to interest me. And it pursued me when I picked my thesis advisor in medical school. I wanted somebody where I could work on the interaction between the brain and the body in some ways. And that was sort of before this became sort of really acceptable to the mainstream medicine. But I did find somebody after a long search who was doing research, fundamental research on brain-heart interactions, sympathetic nervous system regulating blood flow and coronary blood flow. And then after an externship at the Mass General in gastroenterology, it shifted myself from the clinical specialty of gastroenterology was just more interesting to me than cardiology at the time. This was in the late 70s. And then from that time on, I pursued that original interest in mind-body, which went back really to my late teens, I would say. I don't know why, quite honestly. I don't have any symptoms like that. So a lot of people get to that point because they have some problem. I did not. I've initially focused on irritable bowel syndrome, which was sort of the most likely that people would accept, brain-gut interactions. But then, you know, with the microbiome revolution about 10+ years ago, I sort of realized this has a much wider impact, this brain-gut microbiome interaction than IBS symptoms. And so really branched out and was lucky to get on either SPI or co-PI on a variety of grants from autism spectrum disorder to early cognitive decline and IBD, where that system played a role. So then I sort of left IBS behind. That to me was a lot more interesting, this bigger picture, and have sort of been pursuing this ever since. And founding this UCLA Microbiome Center was driven by that same, the main emphasis is on brain-gut microbiome interactions in that center.
Yes, yes. So before we dive into that question, I would love for you to give our audience your perspective on the aging process and longevity.
Well, so I have to say that I'm not a longevity researcher, but with studying and realizing the deep involvement of the brain-gut microbiome system, I call it because it's not an axis, it's not a one-directional interaction of the brain with the gut or the other way around. It's these multiple feedback loops that connect, you know, the brain, the immune system, the gut microbiome, what I like to call the gut connectome. with each other. And we know now that one outcome of these interactions, if they're being perturbed chronically, is low-grade inflammation. And obviously, low-grade inflammation is a key factor in aging, in many processes, but in aging. So all these diseases that we see that I think are related to that, as Hippocrates said, all diseases start in the gut. I mean, it wasn't quite correct, but almost, I'd say all the chronic diseases start in the gut. And obviously these chronic diseases like chronic non-alcoholic liver disease and colon cancer and, you know, IBD and early cognitive decline, coronary disease, they all affect our major factors in longevity. So I would say, now there are studies that have looked, there's a few studies that have looked at the changes of the brain gut microbiome system in aging. Which would obviously expect, because I mean the brain changes, the gut to a lesser degree, but that with aging, the signaling, the baseline of the signaling changes. And but what's come out, you know, of this research is the and then there's like always in this field, there's some diverging opinions on this, but that somebody who lives a healthy lifestyle with exercise and a healthy diet, particularly, the microbiome will not change that dramatically. What we have initially thought are these age-related changes in the microbiome are really to the age-related changes in these lifestyles for many people. And so on the other hand, you could say, you know, can you, and there is evidence for that, that with modifications of these various lifestyle factors that affect the brain gut microbiome system, many studies have shown that you can add 5 to 10 disease-free years to your life. So I think there's clearly the data that not just that you can find it if you do studies, but also that interventions have a major impact on longevity.
Well, so to begin with, that's great news that it's a variable of lifestyle, because that's something that everybody has some control over. But let's take a step back, and you know, you've talked about the bidirectional interactions between brain, gut, the immune system, and how they form a system for essentially for homeostasis. Mm-hmm. Can you explain how that works so we have a foundation for our conversation?
Yeah, so the early concepts, you know, that we had, and that it's still prevalent really amongst physicians and researchers, that there's the brain gut axis, that, you know, the brain affects things that go on within the gut. And there's a lot of people, particularly amongst my colleagues and in gastroenterology, to think the opposite way. It's all in the gut that affects, you know, the brain. But in reality, as I mentioned earlier, we are in the midst of a paradigm shift in science, in society as well, but in focus on science, that we look at complex systems, not identifying, you know, a particular receptor subtype or a particular node in the system, but and that has led to the change in the nomenclature. For example, we don't talk about brain regions, but we talk now about the brain connectome. I like to talk about the gut connectome, because it connects immune cells, nerve cells, endocrine cells, and epithelial cells together. And then we don't talk about microbiota, but we talk about the microbiome with all the genetic information. And these systems, they're all systems. You can understand all these entities as systems, but they're not independent. So they're part of a larger. So you can scale it up. And ultimately, you know, there's some people have shown us that this scaling up to different levels goes even beyond the body. I mean, there's networks in our social environment that affect our genome, and it translates it down. So I've become a huge fan. I mean, if I started my career over again, I would definitely have a major emphasis on systems biology and the mathematics that it takes. It essentially changes the way you do the statistics and you analyze the data. It's
Emeryn, can you give an example of that? Like the systems and how impact.
So for example, you know, when we started with brain imaging, I don't know, 25 years ago, everybody was talking about, and you know, a lot of lay people have seen this in the media, that the region lights up. So like the amygdala lights up more in people that are more anxious and more stressed. And so in the meantime, that's completely abandoned, you know, that regional lighting up, this regional hyperactivity. It's now how connected is the amygdala with all the brain regions or with specific regions within the brain, and how these mathematically expressed connectivity measures, how they related to disease processes, for example. It's made it more difficult because you need larger sample sizes. So before, you know, we published papers, a lot of people published papers with 20 individuals. There was a recent article in Nature or Science that said that you could basically forget about all these publications, because if you try to repeat them in larger samples, none of them would be reproducible. So now we're looking at data sets of hundreds, thousands of patients, and look at these connectivity measures within a system within the brain. So, you know, a lay example of this would be if you want to understand, if you want to understand how a city functions, and you focus on one aspect, which could be, I don't know what to pick. I mean, the mayor. Could you explain if the mayor is male or female, or what age the mayor has? Could you explain the complexity of a city, which, you know, we know you can't. And the same way of looking at the interconnectedness of elements.
Right.
I find it intriguing. You know, ancient healing traditions have understood this empirically and intuitively. You know, Buddhism is essentially it's not a religion, it's a teaching of interconnectedness in every aspect. You know, Ayurvedic theory is kind of a similar, not as clear cut as Buddhism, but then it continued all the way onto the Greeks, and only with the Renaissance and with Descartes, with the true Western, breakthrough of the Western scientific thought, we've kind of abandoned this holistic or systems based analysis or understanding, and I find it really intriguing that we're coming back to this. Science is moving back in that direction, and many examples for that. So I mentioned the brain connectome or the gut connectome. You know, still most of my colleagues in GI, they are fascinated by, you know, this like the serotonin containing cells in the gut, and that's the biggest seed of location of our serotonin. But they don't realize that these serotonin cells are connected to everything else, to certain microbes, to the immune cells, to the enteric nervous system, with the gut connectome, essentially. And ultimately, I think we'll be able to explain altered gut function with this gut connectome concept, not with individual cells.
The goal of optimal functioning would be to maintain this homeostasis or place of balance between these different parts of the body, the brain, the gut, and the immune system. What are some of the main things that throw off that homeostasis, that cause imbalance in the system?
Yeah, so I should emphasize, systems obviously have a bandwidth within which they can oscillate. That's their resilience, obviously a key hallmark of any system. And some people based on genetic background have a wider bandwidth of resistance than others. And there's two kind of perturbations that affect this brain gut microbiome homeostatic system. One component comes from the outside world, so we call now the exposome, which is really another fancy term for the environmental factors, anything from diet, toxins, stressors, psychosocial stressors, and then you have the other group of perturbations which are diet related. So our systems are optimized for a certain diet that our ancestors have eaten for hundreds of thousands of years, with variations, and these variations were within the bandwidth of the system. But what has happened in the last 75 years, there has been such a dramatic change in lifestyle and diet, that this is becoming a perturbation for the brain gut microbiome system that it cannot deal properly with. And essentially, whenever the bandwidth is overcome, a key response of the system is an engagement of the immune system, which is kind of we had the nervous, the stress response of the nervous system of the brain, but then we have a sort of a more ancient immune system stress response, which will cause engagement of, the innate immune system and then the adaptive immune system. And it will lead to this finding that we have today that so many people, even on the outside, healthy people have markers for this low-grade inflammation.
You're saying that whether it's the outside environment and stressors, what was the word you used?
Exposome.
Exposomes. Or it's some aspects of the diet, they take the body out of this place of balance that the body is actually, it's okay to have some flexibility. Flexibility is good, but either the diet or the external stressors take this out further out of balance, and it affects the immune system. How else does it impact that, the microbiome?
We know both from studies, animal studies and human studies, that that stress, even acute stress, changes the gut microbiome composition and function. And there's lots of studies now with diet in animals. It's one of the shortcomings of this whole field of microbiome science that we have a lot more animal studies that point to causality and very few human studies. Most of the human studies are cross-sectional, epidemiological, observational, but big numbers, so like comparing in a population of like the Harvard nursing study, 20 plus thousand people, we can compare those on a certain diet compared to those on another diet. And then you look at their health status and measurements. But in terms of causality, that's harder to derive from the human studies. So now the studies coming up that actually fill this gap, with the microbiome research, it's been an interesting phenomenon. I mean, it's early on. It's 10 years essentially, and I think we're still at the very beginning of understanding it, and so people have prematurely jumped on the findings from the animal studies and the human association studies to talk about causality, you know, is next week's two papers coming out in Nature Communication, in Nature, about association between depression and the gut microbiome in large data sets. But it certainly does not prove that these altered gut microbiome compositions and diversity measures are really play a causal role in depression. It could be the other way around. It could be that if your mind is depressed and the outflow of the autonomic nervous system and HPA access to the body are altered, that this alters the milieu that the microbes live in. And so it's we're at an interesting stage. I think it's I would say, if I had to bet my money on it, I think that that these changes that we talked about, these perturbations of the system, probably play the major role in the observations of the microbiome changes that we see, rather than saying the main new world is now all the mental disorders can be explained by microbiome changes. I don't believe that.
Let me say that I'm glad you said what you would put your money on, because that's partly what we're interested in, is you, who comes from this knowledge base, this huge knowledge base in this area, have some opinions about what the connections are and the significance of those connections. So I'm very much interested in your perspective, because, you know, we're learning so much about the interaction between the microbiome and our emotions, as well as the microbiome and how it might impact cognitive functioning. So I would love for you to share what your perspective is on those connections and perhaps the causality, or at least what imbalance may seem to be correlated with those impairments, whether it's emotional or mental.
Yeah, so I mean, I should mention, you know, I looked at your book that will be coming out, that you were nice enough to send me, so this, the PDF, and obviously you couldn't agree more with the concepts that you laid out there in terms of, you know, how perceptions and your way you cope with stress, what impact this has. It's been kind of a development. So I'm a scientist. I've come up with hypotheses. I believe them. I try to refine them on an ongoing basis. I believe them as long as they fit the data and the observations. And when the science deviates from it, then I'm always willing to change it. And so right now, what I feel is that with our chronic diseases that, you know, have a period often of, like with Parkinson's, of 12 to 15 years, where you don't really develop the full-blown neurological syndrome, but you can detect things in the gut, you know, with constipation and biopsies. And same thing with cognitive decline. You could probably, pick up people, we know it today, that have an increased risk in the earliest signs of this neuroinflammation and neurodegeneration. I think these chronic diseases where you have decades of this abnormal signaling, like this immune signaling to the brain, I think those are the ones where the microbiome plays a significant role, both in terms of early diagnosis, possibly, that you can predict if you do a microbiome analysis at the age of 40 or 50, that you can predict the risk, I mean, together with other factors, of that person developing Alzheimer's disease, same with Parkinson's, that may potentially play a role also with some forms of depression, particularly the forms of depression that people have found evidence for inflammation, for this low-grade inflammation. But I think a lot of the other ones, anxiety, attention deficit disorders. I'm very skeptical. Even IBS, sort of my own, you know, area of long-time interest. The evidence is very mixed that microbes play a causative role in IBS, but a lot of evidence suggests the stress that people with IBS are under changes the microbial ecosystem, you know. And so I would say I see two different types of disorders. The one that have low-grade chronic inflammation as a key pathophysiological component, I think they are related. We know they are related to diet, and diet is always translated through the microbiome into, you know, molecules that affect the immune system. So I think that's a whole group of disorders where this microbiome concept and a causative role is quite likely. Mm-hmm. The others, I haven't seen really the proof of it. You know, I think, but then, as I said earlier, we're just at the beginning of this field. I mean, there may be dramatic changes all of a sudden that you know will suddenly change my opinion on it.
So yeah, there's always, and with human studies, it's even more difficult to determine what's causative and what's just correlational. And I know that's always an ongoing kind of question in a lot of these areas. Hopefully we'll keep getting more and more information that gives us the answers. But can you just explain how the gut microbiome affects the brain? What's the communication process there?
Yeah, so there's multiple communication pathways. So one of the main sources for that we influence and feed our microbiome is clearly our diet, you know, and the ideal diet for the microbes. We've deviated from that increasingly over the last 50, 75 years. So the complex carbohydrates and fiber that's contained in plant-based foods, for example. So we know a lot about this, how it's broken down by microbes into short-chain fatty acids that, you know, have both beneficial effects on the integrity of the gut, but also the short-chain fatty acids are sort of our body's aspirin because they have anti-inflammatory effects on every level, from the enteric nervous system to, you know, anywhere in the body, and particularly within the brain. So you could almost say that this may be the main factor why we have these brain disorders, because we don't have the same level of built-in anti-inflammation that counteracts, you know, the inflammatory signals. The other ones are metabolites that are generated, so not just the short-chain fatty acids, metabolites that are generated from, for example, from molecules that our body produces. Just want to mention one example. Estrogen is a good example, which is conjugated in the liver, excreted through the bile into the second half of the small intestine. And then a certain fraction of these are metabolized by certain microbes into a reabsorbable form of estrogen. So then it circulates back in the body. And depending on if you have the right group of microbes that can do this, you will have higher levels of estrogen, like, you know, postmenopausal state or other situations, than somebody who doesn't have these microbes. Mm-hmm. Another source are dietary components. So probably the best study example is tryptophan, which can be metabolized either with the help of microbes. Serotonin synthesis is accomplished in specialized endocrine hormonal cells in the gut. But the main signals that stimulates this this enzyme that converts tryptophan to serotonin is modulated by the gut microbes through short-chain fatty acids and secondary bile acids. But then there's other tryptophan metabolites. Some of them have positive effects, some have negative effects on brain integrity and excitotoxicity within the brain. So it also shows you the complexity. So one molecule, tryptophan, you know, portion of, probably the majority is absorbed in the small intestine, goes into the systemic circulation, is taking up in cells in the brain that produce serotonin for brain regulation. But then a smaller portion is metabolized by the microbes at the end of the small intestine into these other metabolites that have, you know, like serotonin, canurinine, and indoles that have a complex interaction with each other. The ratio of these molecules is influenced by chronic stress and by diet. So that's where it gets complex. That's where you see how the systems work. They don't work with one molecule. You know, you don't, like, just taking serotonin by itself is not sufficient. I mean, that's not how the body works. It works with both yin and yang and antagonizing forces to get the ultimate signal.
Yeah. So I'm hearing some very important things here right now, which is that the best way to maintain optimal levels of, say, neurotransmitters or hormones is to have this gut and the microbiome operating at its optimal level. That one of the consequences of it operating in homeostasis and balanced and not off balance is that it helps maintain levels of hormones and neurotransmitters. And that's very important when we start talking about longevity, because one of the factors in longevity is with age, how some of our hormones, neurotransmitters start to decrease. And what I'm hearing you say is a healthy gut is one way to maintain optimal levels. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's clearly different physiological, you know, demands on the hormonal system. You know, we don't, as older males, we don't need the same amount of androgens, and the same thing is true about female sex hormones. But we also don't want to drop below the level that's optimal for a certain age. And I think that's where the microbiome and diet comes in. Much more than, you know, sort of another area for me, I've gone back and forth in terms of the supplements. You know, is it with aging, is it a good idea to take all kinds of supplements to try to reverse the natural process of adaptation of the hormones to a different steady state, you know, which you could say is the right steady state. I mean, and I haven't totally come to the right conclusion on that, quite honestly. You know, I think I still believe if you are pursuing a healthy lifestyle with a healthy diet, exercise, you know, mindfulness, sleep hygiene, that effect is much, much bigger on the system than taking high doses of a certain, you know, of a certain chemical. The same thing is true about probiotics. You know, if you take billions of colony-forming units of 15 different strains of microbes, I mean, is that really going to do more than pursuing these other avenues, which I think are the key towards healthy longevity, you know?
So I'm glad you brought up supplements, because one question I had for you is, does the body fully utilize these supplements when we take them in or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, there's different kinds of supplements. I mean, some are absorbed in the small intestine. The system has not evolved to sort of take care of a very high dose that you take. What you ingest with nutrition is a kind of a different paradigm. You take in a lot of different chemicals and substances in small amounts, but on a regular basis, as opposed to, you know, giving like a big boost of one chemical at, you know, without paying attention to all the rest. So it's a little bit like Chinese medicine, you know, where they mix different things together in lower doses, whereas Western medicine goes for the one, you know, big hit. So we don't really know this for sure. A good example where that is definitely not the case is this whole story about antioxidants, you know, still prevalent if you look at the media and online recommendations. So there's a group of, there's several molecules, there's certain vitamins, but there's a lot of what's called these polyphenols, these big molecules that are contained in plants, virtually in all plants. The plants use these molecules and make these molecules to defend themselves against disease. So it's kind of interesting. And when we ingest these molecules, they cannot be absorbed in the small intestine. They go down, and we need the microbes to break them down into smaller components. And it's believed that a very small portion, based on science, a very small portion of these orally ingested antioxidants, that a very small portion really acts as antioxidants because they're converted into something totally different by the microbes that then, you know, acts on our body and our brain. And there's been a recent publication, you know, it's the kind of studies we would like to see, a 3-year study with flavanols. So it's one form, a common form of polyphenols given in a capsule form over 3 years. And look at its impact on the brain, on the hippocampus, on cognitive function, and on cardiovascular function. And it did show that, you know, over these 3 years when people consumed this high amount of that particular molecule, that it had a benefit. And what's important here is it had a benefit in people that did not consume an adequate amount in their natural diet, in their normal diet. It had no benefits in people that were, you know, consuming a diet high in these flavanol-containing ingredient components. Mm. So I would say, with our, you know, extremely unique diet, this what's called the Standard American Diet, or SAD by its acronym. it may well be that certain supplements that you take, such as these flavanols, I've actually started taking them myself, you know, but I was convinced by the evidence that I saw, that may be beneficial, you know. But I think for the majority of people that continue their unhealthy lifestyle or their unhealthy diet, it doesn't make a difference, you know. That's kind of another thing, that because you have these interactions of these different lifestyle factors, each contributing, you know, we don't know, between 5, let's say, and 15% to the variance of the overall outcome. Each individual intervention is not the determining factor. It's the combination of them that produces the longevity.
Yeah. So again, it says that usually the natural way of producing change is the best way. But what I also heard you suggest, I think, there is that when you take supplements, if you have deficits, it can help correct that or contribute to a better result. But if you're already doing well, a supplement may not make that even better. Is that correct?
That's sort of the current thinking, you know. So say it in a, you know, sort of a political way, the people that would need the supplements the most are the ones in the lower socioeconomic parts of our society,
right?
Because they are on an unhealthy diet much more than people living in the west side of Los Angeles or New York. Mm-hmm. And so they would need it the most, but they probably would not be able to afford it. You know, right. They can't even afford the healthy diet. So that's why they eat at McDonald's.
Right.
And so it's, I mean, if you really want to make a big impact with supplementation, I think it would require sort of a public health effort to get it to the people that need it the most, you know, to both teach individuals in this segment of our society, teach them about the health benefits and the danger of an unhealthy diet, and provide both the diet but also potentially the supplements on a regular basis.
Yeah. So yes. So it also suggests we need to do a better job at informing the public on all of these subjects.
Absolutely.
One of the things that's come up in a couple of our other conversations on this summit has been, like, for example, the impact of mouthwash on the oral biome and also antibiotics as well. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, so this, you know, I said earlier, so the increase in many of these chronic non-transmittable diseases, the epidemic in these diseases. So diet is one thing, but also the excessive and inappropriate use of antibiotics from early on in life, both starting with the pregnant mother. You know, animal studies have shown that even the one dose of antibiotic to a pregnant mouse mother could affect the microbiome of the offspring. But then also will be, you know, during delivery in the delivery room, you know, the prophylaxis for staph infection, where often antibiotics are given. And then the first few years of life were often, you know, the pediatricians are pressured by over-concerned mothers that their child is suffering from a respiratory tract infection. He or she needs an antibiotic. And so we end up with a situation where during the time where this brain gut microbiome system is shaped, so the most important formative time, we bombard it with antibiotics, which impair the normal development from before birth to after birth. And so I'm not sure if that practice has really changed despite, you know, lots of publications on this topic. I mean, there's also, you know, the whole vaginal versus C-section delivery conversation, which, you know, has a major effect on this development during the first year, but then it normalizes after a year. But during that first year, a lot of the interaction between the microbes and the immune system happens. So all this increase in these autoimmune diseases and allergies, you know, like many of these allergies did not exist when I was a medical student that we now deal with and patients talk about. That's another impact of you know, these changes we've made within the medical system. So even before this child gets to pursue his or her own lifestyle with potential negative effects, it's already handicapped compared to some other individual growing up in a different society.
So are you suggesting that the impairment of the gut microbiome is responsible for these allergies, or what's the relationship with the growing prevalence of allergies?
So it's the interaction of, so there's kind of a learning phase for the immune system. So each of these systems, you know, like the gut microbiome, the immune system, and our brain have these different periods of training in when somebody's growing up in the life cycle. So the first, you know, I mean, the first couple of years, the microbiome is influenced significantly. It's shaped, it's basic. Then the immune system is compromised because the interaction of many benign microbes with immune cells, with innate immune cells, teaches the immune system what's good and bad for them. You know, there are organisms like H. pylori, there's a range of these are called the old friends hypothesis. So these organisms that have lived with us, with humans, for thousands of years and still live, if you go to indigenous people like on the Amazon or in the Orinoco River, they have all these organisms still. And parasites are also part of this. And what these organisms, they don't kill anybody. They don't kill the infected individuals, but they train the immune cells to differentiate between if a really bad pathogen comes along to attack that one, but not the cells or the immune cells of the host that are not dangerous. So this whole teaching of differentiating between good and bad happens during that time period. And you know, when if you interfere with this, in the West we've done this in many ways: sterile delivery rooms, as I mentioned earlier, the C-section delivery, so they're not exposed to the mom's microbiome. Then living in city apartments instead of on farms or in settings with lots of green spaces and exposure to animals. So all this has contributed. And the system is resilient, so not everybody develops these allergies, but in combination with genetic risk factors, you know, that's definitely one of the major reasons. And it will continue to increase. With more and more people moving into urban environments and away from, from these green spaces, this will continue to increase. Pets, to a certain degree, can attenuate this if they're present from early on. Dogs more than cats. When you go down the whole developmental, the way we have interacted with our brain-gut microbiome system from pregnancy all the way to old age, in senior citizen homes, the lower quality of food with less fiber and all these things add up to that we have more of these diseases. And in the West, we're actually very good in increasing longevity but with an enormous investment of trillions of dollars of medications and surgeries and medical interventions. So it's
this is a fascinating conversation, Amarin, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm also struck by what you just said, which is that there's an actual biological learning process that takes place that trains different systems as well, because it correlates with some of the things that I've written about how our early developmental process affects how we adapt as adults. Mm-hmm. And here you're saying that there's a similar biological process that takes place inside of us. So I find that fascinating. But my last couple of questions: if someone has been taking antibiotics, or maybe it's a result of what happened during birth, how does one normalize or restore a healthy microbiome? Is there a way of actually regaining a healthy natural biome?
So, the thing is, we still don't have a good answer of what is a healthy microbiome. Is it the one that so always come back to these indigenous people on the upper Orinoco, because I was fortunate to visit them in some time point in my early career during college. And so they supposedly have the greatest diversity of anybody in the world on the planet of their microbiome. And, I wasn't interested at the time, at my age at the time as a medical student, or before being a medical student. But in retrospect, when you look at at their diet and their exposure to natural to soil, and they're born on the ground on a banana leaf, and so they do all the things that nurture this healthy microbiome. But then you could say they have a healthy microbiome for their environment. You know, ours has adapted, and the microbes can adapt rapidly, really within 24 hours. To, if you go from a meat eater to a vegetarian diet habit, you you know, the microbes can adapt to this quickly because they have 100 million genes, so they're much better at this than we as humans are with our human genes. So the big question is, should we aim for having a gut microbiome like the Yanomami Indians who live in a totally different environment, and should we, you know, define our healthy microbiome as taking the healthiest people that live in the US, and make that the ideal, you know? So I think this question has not totally been settled.
What would you advise somebody who either feels like there's something off with their microbiome, or have just gone through surgery or whatever and have had antibiotics? What would be your recommendation?
So my recommendation would be, as always, go on this what I would almost call the healthy default diet, you know, which is a diet rich in a large variety of plant-based foods, both fruits and vegetables, as well as a large variety of fermented foods. Mm-hmm. So there's evidence that both of these types of foods have an influence on microbial diversity and on this inflammatory response. So if you do this for a while, you're probably doing the most, you know, the most effective based on science that we know today.
So that
I mean, you know, people have also recommended or are doing taking a probiotic. My guess is if I develop GI symptoms from a course of antibiotics, I would probably take a probiotic in addition to these naturally fermented foods. But the evidence is mixed. I mean, some studies have shown that if you take a probiotic in that situation, it takes longer for your own gut microbes to come back. So your probiotic suppresses the reestablishment of your healthy. So I think it so depends. I would definitely go with the diet intervention first, and if that doesn't work, then I might, you know, take a probiotic.
Thank you. Very, very good. So we're running out of time. I had one last question, and I wanted to know if you could share what interests you the most with your own work right now.
Well, I mean, I can't wait for the first credible, results from human studies that demonstrate that some of these hypotheses that we currently have based on these correlational epidemiological studies is actually causative, and because that would open up a whole range of interventions that you can then, you know, target at the gut microbiome. Another thing that's very interesting is, you know, we have moved away from analyzing and putting a lot of weight on the individual microbes. We're interested really what they produce, what genes they express, and what molecules they produce, and to understand how that interaction of thousands of these molecules affects us, the host, you know, body and health and disease. That's another, I think, going to be a very exciting breakthrough to be able to say that. In the meantime, you know, I'm excited about studies that we have ongoing where we look, for example, at these polyphenols. What effect do they have on brain structure and function? And how does that relate to cognitive performance? But that's just a small aspect of it. I think the big picture is will take 10, 20 years, I'm sure, still. And but it will fundamentally change medicine. I think there's we're on the verge of a major paradigm shift, I think, in medicine.
This is also fascinating, and I really appreciate your perspective and sharing this very valuable and important information, Emran. I know you've got some best-selling books out. Can you give the names of those books as well as how people can reach you?
Yeah, so I published two books. The first one, The Mind-Gut Connection, where I essentially laid out the basic communication systems between the mind, the brain, and the gut and its microbes. And the second one, The Gut-Immune Connection, which is kind of almost like a sequel to it. It brings in the immune system as a sort of a main transduction mechanism to our health. And both of these books are available on Amazon. Go to my website, emranmeyer.com, and you can sign up for our newsletter and other materials, which addresses topics related to this on a weekly basis. So I would encourage anybody who's interested to go to these possibilities.
Very good. And then if you have something you want to offer, we will, in the notes from this lecture, we will include that so that people can reach out to you for that.
Okay. I'll definitely provide you with that.
All right. Beautiful, beautiful. So, Emran, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much again. And I'm looking forward to the next time we communicate, when you'll have some additional information to share with the audience. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen, for having me on this show. It's really been, I always enjoy it to be able to share this information.
Great.
This is for general information and educational purposes only, and it's not intended to constitute or substitute for medical advice or counseling. The practice of medicine or the provision of healthcare, diagnosis, or treatment, or the creation of a physician patient or clinical relationship. The use of this information is at their own user's risk. If you find this to be on the value, please hit that like button to subscribe to support the work that we do on this channel. And we take your suggestions and advice very seriously, so please let us know what you'd like to see on this channel. Thanks for watching, and we hope to see you next time.